Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, June 5th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon and Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we'd appreciate doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press the number 1 on your phone, it'll put the icon of a hand by your phone number. We will see it. I can then turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And we greatly appreciate anytime anybody does that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service. And if you let us know how things are landing for you, that's just so much easier for us to do, to be of service. If you're not able to call live or choose not to, we can accept emails. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. So please let us know how things are landing for you, and what would be of most benefit for us to spend our time together. So yesterday we played the replay of Friday's show because I was taking my sister to another cataract surgery and supporting her through that. And then last night we had our support group. And it's fascinating to me how every one of those support groups is valuable. And yet every once in a while, things fall together in a way that I think, you know what, I've got to re-listen to this. I've got to go back and get the recording here. And that's what happened last night. It was one of those lovely synergies between questions and struggles people were having and the material that we study in a variety of different formats. And my experience of it was worth a review. So I'm in the process of doing that, and I might make some notes. And one of the things that I was talking about in the group is, as I have read and then shared with this Mindshifters Radio group, some of the letters from the Yeshua letters about allowance and about how we are not going to think our way into enlightenment, etc. The message is coming at me from all kinds of different angles. Guy Finley talks about it that way. He talks about the mechanical level of mind. Dr. Michael Rice talks about the idea of trying to figure it out as the number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind, of the egoic mind, of the mind that's stuck in hostility and fear. And then the other day I was listening to Sadhguru. He's got a rather lengthy book, and in the middle of it, he's hitting exactly the same point, that what yogis and what swamis understand is that we're not supposed to have our conscious logical mind or our intellect be our primary user interface for life. We're supposed to use our heart, our wide open heart, the awakened heart is the Way of Mastery calls it, or our intuition, our inspiration, our energy field sensitivity, whatever you want to call it, however you want to look at it. And there is a tremendous amount of information and guidance for us that does not come from what's been programmed into us in the conscious, logical, and emotional. I meant to say the conscious, logical, and what some people would call rational mind. That's why in the Reality Management Worksheet, Dr. Michael Rice talks about what David Bohm and Krishnamurti came to, is that there's a fundamental flaw in the process of thought, and that fundamental flaw in the process of thought, when thought is directed at our mental, emotional difficulties, the flaw itself prevents us from ever finding a solution to our problem. I can't engage in a process and in that process create a problem and then decide, oh, I know how to fix this. I'll do more of what I did to get into this mess. It won't work. That's what David Bohm calls sustained incoherence. And it's what all of the great spiritual traditions that resonate well with me talk about. So I was listening to Sadhguru, and he talks about a story, which may or may not have been true, but he said it doesn't really matter because it has the ring of truth to it. And the story is that Aristotle, the great philosopher, was walking on the beach and deeply lost in thought, trying to use his powerful intellect to rationalize everything in life and come up with answers to all of life's problems. And this one day when he was out walking on the beach, he walked by a man who seemed so focused on what he was doing that it grabbed Aristotle's attention. And so Aristotle stopped his ruminations and his philosophical spinning, and he started to watch the man. And the man walked into the ocean, had a little tablespoon with him, and walked back and went over to a little hole in the beach and poured the water from the ocean into the hole. But he was so focused, he didn't seem to notice anything about the other people around or the birds. He was just so focused that his focus grabbed Aristotle's attention. And as Aristotle watched him, he realized that he's just doing the same thing over and over again. And so he asked the man, "What are you doing?" And eventually the man said, "I'm emptying the ocean into a hole in the beach using this teaspoon." And Aristotle laughed and told him to stop being ridiculous. And the man said, "My work is already done." And Aristotle said, "Your work isn't done. The ocean is still full and the hole is empty. What do you mean? You're being ridiculous." And the man dropped the spoon and said, "My work here is done. I'm trying to empty the ocean with a spoon. What are you trying to do? Do you know how vast experience and existence is? Existence can contain a billion oceans like this and more. And you're trying to empty it into the small hole of your head. And with what? With teaspoons called thoughts." In a flash, that man had showed Aristotle what a crippled existence he was leading by attempting to extend his logic to every aspect of life. If you want to know life in its fullness, you need something more than the intellect. Way of Mastery, in the very first lesson, suggests that we recognize every negative thought in the intellect as a warning signal that the intellect is no longer the appropriate user interface for us with life, and that the way of the heart suggests and invites us into developing and strengthening the awakened heart and using your awakened heart as your primary interface with life. It says right on the fifth page, right after it introduces us to the first axiom, the first axiom of truth. And what they're saying here is, if you would like to awaken, if you would like to get enlightened, the important thing to do is let this first step be just letting this thought of the first axiom of truth, let it into your mind and let it bounce around there and play around with it some. That first axiom of truth is, quote, "Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice," close quotes. And they acknowledge right away that your intellect is going to jump up and say, "But that's ridiculous. I've done this and I've done that and I must correct it and no one is to blame and the world is innocent. And that, how could that be?" And the intellect wants to argue against the thought that I'm only experiencing the effects of my own choices. And then a little bit later on, four or five paragraphs down, it says, "By the way of the heart," which is the title of this book, this first lesson, the first 12 lessons is the way of the heart. It says, "The way of the heart is not the way of the intellect." And it invites us to pay attention to the fact that lots of great spiritual traditions tell us the intellect was never designed to be our primary user interface in life. It was designed to be a very simple tool that we pick up from time to time and use where it's appropriate. But it's there to serve a higher calling, a higher wisdom, a higher integration of your intellect, intuition, ability to access divine inspiration, your feeling center, your heart. The intellect is not designed to be the way you interface with the world primarily. It's designed to be a very simple tool that cannot think for itself, that cannot discern in the realm of emotion, that can only record what's been loaded into it and replay it when it's called up, like the hard drive on a computer. That's why Dr. Michael Rice calls it the 9-bit mind, because it's this part of our brain that in conscious awareness we can only be aware of 9 bits of information in about 1/25th of a second. But in that same period of time, the brain might be firing 110,000 to 100,000 brain cells firing. And in that same period of time, a conservative estimate is that there's probably 20 trillion bits of information hitting our senses, just the 5 senses, let alone the other senses that are probably there that we haven't been introduced to. So the intellect can't help me navigate through life at anything but the most fundamental, concrete, solid, pre-programmed ways. And everything about the creative geniuses that we've had in our cultures over the years talks to us about how intuition, inspiration, divine inspiration, creativity, these are far more important than the thought process that we call conscious logical mind. So this was a part of the topic yesterday. This is the in the support group that we have such tremendous difficulty even imagining, well, how could I live if my intellect, if my logic wasn't my primary user interface? And what do you mean live without judging? I have to judge. I know that this is wrong and that's wrong and he shouldn't be doing this and this shouldn't be happening there. And all we're trying to point out is that we've got a world full of people who've been trying to do that, live from the logic, sort it out, judge this as bad, that is good, right and wrong. And all it's resulted in over the eons is wars, conflict, emotional struggle and strife, pettiness, because it's the stuff that's been pre-programmed. The way Dr. Michael Rice likes to talk about it is, you know, our intellectual mind, our conscious logical mind, or the human mind, the 9-bit mind, has been programmed by other people who've been programmed by other people who've been wounded. And so imagine you've got a hard drive on a computer and it gets a virus. And instead of running a virus removal software, you just make a copy of the hard drive and stick it in a new computer. So all you're doing is copying the virus and spreading it around. And layer upon layer upon layer of complication and deep, serious difficulty just gets compounded generation after generation after generation. It's not reasonable to think that we can keep doing the same thing over and over again and get any different results. We are not likely to break out of this by using our conscious logical mind, by using what's been programmed into us through our language, through our culture. And that's why swamis, yogis, spiritual teachers for eons have tried to help us see there's another way to go at life. There's a feeling sense. There's a divine inspiration sense. There's the awakened heart sense. Sadhguru talks about how most of us in the Western world are just fascinated with machines, and yet we're being transported around on the planet in the most complex of all machines on the planet right now. It's the human body. And yet we don't even understand how it works. We don't often even take time to give it what it needs in any kind of a balanced and relaxed way. We don't listen to its feedback and integrate the wisdom that it can give us about when it's tired and when it's time to relax and when it's time to tap into creativity. And we judge it. We judge it as bad or wrong because it's not slender enough or it can't lift enough weights or it can't attract this kind of person or activity. And what the Way of Mastery and the Yeshua Letters and Guy Finley's work and Dale Ellen Hoffman's work and Michael Rice's work and Gangaji's work and Byron Katie's work, what all of these are asking us to do at a fundamental level, inviting us to do, if you will, is move into questioning at deeper and deeper levels and recognize that every time my mind wants to tell me that it knows something, that's probably better used as an alarm system than a guidance system. Right? It's probably a better indication that if my mind is getting tighter, tense, and firmly stating with, you know, righteous indignation. And we had somebody in the group last night who was just, you know, getting indignant at the thought that whatever purpose that she's attributed to her life may not be all there is to the life, or that any thought that I create about what my life purpose is just made up. And she was generating a tremendous amount of intensity, the various emotional words that went with that intensity were fear, anger, indignation. And all we're trying to do with this work, we're not trying to tell people they're right or they're wrong. We're just trying to invite them to recognize you have a feedback system. When your body starts to tighten, when you have a belief that you have to defend your statement or your belief, it's probably better used as an alarm system to tell you you're off the mark, that you're trying to use this very limited intellect and the process of judgment as your primary user interface. And when you do that, you exclude realms of information, encyclopedias full of information which could be available to you to make your decision about how to proceed or to make your choice about how to proceed. Tightness, tension, you know, willingness to argue about something, desire to argue about something, a sense of urgency to argue about something, probably better used as an alarm system to tell you that in that moment, what you're identifying with, what you're ready to fight for, is taking you out of the bigger picture, is taking you out of connection to the experience of yourself as the extension of loving energy and form. And if you follow it, it'll take you down a rabbit hole that will give you more of that tightness and tension and more of that solid feeling. I love it when Guy Finley has several of his talks where he talks about, just think about it for yourself. Just observe this for yourself. You never feel so solid as when you're angry about something. You never feel so certain that you're right when you're enraged about something. So two things. One is, when we have anger, it gives us this really solid feeling. And so that contributes to the set of conclusions we have that we must be right, because we've been programmed into this belief that when we feel that solid, when we feel that energy of rage or tension, that means we're right and the world or the person in front of us is wrong. But there's another level that Guy Finley brings to that in his understanding, and he says, it's a good thing to wake up to the fact that when I'm angry, it doesn't mean I'm right. It means that in that moment, when anger is active in my system, that I have no idea what rightness is. And that's just Guy Finley's way of saying what a lot of these deep spiritual traditions say. The tightness, the tension, the anger, they're an alarm system. They're best used as an alarm system. They are not used as verification for who's right and who's wrong. Just flashed into my mind from Robert Bolton's book, People Skills. He's got this dynamic in that book about reflective listening. And he talks about how in the effort of communication, we have so many things that distort our communication that we're not aware of. You might call them filters. You might call them blind spots, etc. And as an example, he talks about how in the military, and especially in the Navy, they would develop years ago before they had all the radar and encrypted phone signals, etc., and code through radio, what they would do is they would use Morse code and they would flash a light in dots and dashes according to the Morse code, which would spell out the letters of the alphabet. And they would send messages with flashes of light. And later when they had the telegraph, they would do it with, you know, clicks on an electrical wire. So they thought, this is great. We've got these big bright spotlights with louvered, horizontal blinds on it that we can open and close so the light can shine through and then get shut down, and we can do these flashes of light in longer and shorter bursts, and we can communicate with Morse code. And it was great. And they would send a code and say, okay, and then act as though the other ship received the message accurately. And sometimes it worked, but other times they would still crash into each other. So they researched it to try and find out, what's the problem here? Why aren't we more effective in these communications? And they realized, well, wait a minute, if I'm shining a light and I'm out in the ocean, there might be a fog bank that moves between me and the other light, or some fog that obscures some of the signal. Or there might be a big wave that comes up. We might be in a choppy ocean, and so they're only getting part of the signal. So they decided the only reasonable thing to do is ship A sends a signal, and ship B receives it, and then ship A says, that's the end of the message, and over. And then ship B has to repeat that message back to ship A, point for point, letter for letter, and say, is this correct? Over. And then ship A has to say, yes, you got it. You got the whole message and you got it accurately. And unless that happens, we don't take action, because too many things can screw up that message. So the story that comes to mind is that in that signal, within that set of communications, there's a light that's shining and flashing a message, and the ship says to the other ship, move to the left because I'm coming through on the right. And B, quote, ship, close quote, B says, no, you move to the right even further, because I'm staying here. And ship A says, we have the admiral aboard. You better move to the left because we're coming through on the right. And ship B, quote, ship B says, no, we're staying here. You need to move farther to the right. And then the signal comes through. This is Admiral Smith. And doggone it. And if you don't, there's going to be these serious consequences. And, quote, ship, close quotes, B reports, well, this is the Rhode Island Lighthouse, and if you don't move, you're going to have consequences I can't protect you from. So if we don't have the whole message, but we think we do, and we get indignant, and we let our anger be our guide, we're going to bring on, and we've all seen it in our lives, we're going to bring on more and more and more of the pain, fear, and sadness that we've always had. Well, what do I do? How do I get? I have to find an entirely different user interface for my life. One that is more flexible, one that is more far-reaching, one that has more potential to integrate other material, one that is certainly not focused on the conscious logical. Because if I stick with the conscious logical, I'm so limited. In the first place, I'm shutting myself down to a very narrow bandwidth of information. In the second place, if you were raised at least in this Western culture, you're probably going to misinterpret most of the signals and misuse most of the information that comes to you. The primary misuse of the information that comes to us is we've been trained to believe that when we have an intense tightness or tension or negative emotion within us, we've been trained to believe it's being caused by someone or something outside of us. That's a misuse of the information. There's nothing wrong with my emotions. However, I can derive errant, unproductive messages from those emotions. I can use them to build a deeper and deeper hallucination that I'm right and the world is wrong. And all I do in that process is take myself further and further out of the flow of life. So 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, you can let us know, how's this landing for you? How many times in your life have you found it edifying or gratifying or enjoyable to recognize that when you have a negative emotion, it means something about your processing is way off the mark? It's not about life being off the mark. Something about your life will go better if you learn to go with the flow of life, learning to allow, accept, surrender, whatever words you tend to like better. When I mentioned Sadhguru in the group last night, I didn't recognize anybody saying that they were aware of his work or that they followed it. But he's one of my favorites, and raised with a father who was very much into my dad was very much into words and grammar and proper pronunciation and all of that stuff. And he was a primary influence in my life in a very positive way. So I have traditionally over the years struggled in listening to people from other cultures, even though intellectually I know, my gosh, if they've got a heavy accent, that means this isn't their primary language. So they've got an intellectual capacity that's greater than mine in certain ways. And yet I have struggled, especially with certain the accents from certain cultures, I have struggled to focus myself, to pay attention, to distill the meaning when they mispronounce a word, sometimes they speak much more quickly than I do in the English that I was taught. And that was one of the things I had to work to get over with Sadhguru because he clearly has the Indian accent. And yet it's been worth every bit of it for me when him. He's got all kinds of talks on YouTube and he's got books and you know, the current book that I'm listening to on Audible with him has him reading it, so it's his accent is quite prominent. But I'm listening to the book Inner Engineering, A Yogi's Guide to Joy. And it's a long listen, and yet it's just full of gems, like that kind of story. He's got some wonderful stories about the apparent paradoxes or conflicts in life, and yet there's humor and there's a spotlight to shine it on the limitations of my logic and following my logic. And so I bring it in because it's got exactly the same point. The point is, you are not just your body, and you are certainly not your thoughts about your body and about yourself. And there is an entirely different level of experiencing life that can be available to you if you learn to change, I'll call it the tuning device. You learn to tune into different frequencies of energy. You learn to shift away from the identification with this set of thoughts or beliefs and move yourself into that open questioning space. So 563-999-3581. Wide open, plenty of time for a comment or question. We've got about 20, 22 minutes left. And we're open to questions about worksheets, worksheet processes, anything you've heard on this show in the last 13 years. Michael keeps either cutting it down to 12 or pushing it up to 14, but we began in the January of 2011, so you can do your own math. Having finished 13 years of this work, all of it's available for discussion or comment. Observation. I used to open the support groups when we were meeting in person. Frequently, I would open it with an introduction, especially if there were new people there, and say something to the effect of, everything we talk about is not up for debate. It's up for observation, but we're not here to debate. We're not here to beat each other up to demonstrate who's right and who's wrong. We're just here to start observing for ourselves what we might do differently to have a different experience of life, day in and day out, moment to moment. And as Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery would recommend and invite us to, we're invited over and over again to choose for love, to choose for peace, to choose for joy, to choose for the bliss state that people like the Swamis and Michael Singer and that they would tell us is available to us in every given moment, the bliss state. And it goes beyond words, every new heartbeat, and it is not something you can think your way to, and it's not something you can possess or hold on to. It's just already there. And what most of us have been busy doing our entire lives, because that's what we've been trained to do, is distracting ourselves from it or putting layers of effort and conclusions and labels between us, between our conscious experience and that bliss state and our true nature. We had somebody in the group last night who asked, So what do you mean by allowance? And what I say when people ask me about that is, the Western mind, how do I allow? What do I do to allow? And the Western mind wants an activity it can engage in. And yet, what's really going on there is that, you know, when I'm moving into allowance, what I'm doing is moving out of trying to do something and moving more into surrender, openness, softening, observation, etc. And in the book, The Way of Mastery, the little paragraph they have on allowance says it's this art of cultivating. What am I cultivating? I'm cultivating the awareness that whatever unfolds in my life is not blocking me from anything. It's a stepping stone. It's going to take me exactly where I need to be. I don't think so. I want it to be something else. Right? But it is not a roadblock. It is not a punishment. And so the paragraph on allowance says that it's the art of cultivating the awareness that everything that unfolds in my life, especially after I've made the request, especially after I've called out to the Creator or God or Light or Love, and I'd say, take me home, help me be enlightened, help me learn. The paragraph in Way of Mastery says, allowance is the cultivation of a way of looking at all of the events of your life as stepping stones, not as obstacles. Each event in your life, each and every moment of every event in your life presents you with a blessing, even if you feel it is traumatic, even if it creates physical pain. It's a blessing of a lesson that's required to heal any obstacle I have, not an obstacle to success, but as an obstacle of my being aware in the moment that my true nature is the presence of love as the source and ground of my being. My true nature is that I am a conduit for the extension of the loving energy of creation expressing in form. So allowance is the cultivation of a way of looking at life that says, especially if something happens where I say, boy, I hate this, or I really don't like this, or boy, that's painful, looking at every situation that arises that I say I don't want or I wish it didn't have to happen as life saying to me, hey, Tim, would you like to see what's keeping you from knowing me and loving me more deeply? Here it is. It's right in front of you. Here it is. It's driving. It's creating your reaction to this event in the flow of life. How would your life be different if you looked at everything that happened, especially those things that you don't want to have happen, as a way of life trying to show you what you're holding on to that prevents you from living life more fully, knowing it and loving it more deeply? I'd say it's a really good question. What would my life be like if I chose that interpretation for everything that unfolds in my life? And, of course, I can't answer that question unless I step into it and usher myself into an experience of life that's dramatically different than what I've been doing. Susan, welcome.
Hey, hi, Dr. Tim. Well, there are four different things I want to say, and I'm backtracking. you had a replay yesterday of a session with Jamuna that you had done only last week, I think. I just wanted to say I thought it was really good. It deserves to be among the special ones. So there's
Thank
that.
You.
Then the second one is, I would love to have a PDF of those Beatitudes. I know you offered them, and I was away from anywhere where I could ask for that. So,
okay, I'll be happy to send that to you.
Great. We just had an amazing Mindshifter group, too, today, right before the show. It's always on Wednesdays. And one of us, I consider a genius scientist, enlightened man. He's 83 years old. And he said that he has been in terrible pain. He has sciatic pain, very fragile physically now. And in spite of that, when he goes into or feels the presence, capital P, he says the pain is gone. But the pain is a true challenge, because when he's not in the presence, he's really unable to get comfortable at all. But he's alone. He's single. He's living alone in an apartment complex, which is too far away from us to run and go see him very often. But he said one of the things that has come up for him, and it was the question, everybody chimed in and said, oh, yeah, that's a problem for me, too. When in the Bible it says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, or whatever it says, he says, that is too abstract for me. I can't find my way to even relating to that. But I do spend a lot of time in the presence. And he said, when I'm in the presence, I feel tremendous peace. Maybe it's joy, I'm not sure, but I'm totally at peace. That's the best I can say. Then everybody else in the group said, yeah, I've had a problem with that too. Jesus came to us, and so that's one step closer, but he's no longer in the flesh. So I don't really know how to love him either. Michael Rice says, we've never loved anybody, but we're holding a space of love, and I know I'm going all around here, but one of the people, as my teaser, I always send out a quote or something before each meeting as a kind of springboard if we need one. We almost never do. But I sent out a very much reduced, copy-edited version of Michael Rice's long 16 pages single space presentation about what he teaches. It's full of all the good stuff. But he put it up on Facebook, and I said, Michael, people usually just scroll through pretty fast. I'm afraid you're not going to have it very many people who stop and read this whole thing. Good though it may be, how would you feel if I did my own version of copy editing and rearranging it to be shorter for the people who could use a shorter version? He said, oh, yeah, go for it. Well, I only got it down to 6 single space pages, but I got his permission to send it to my group. And they all read it, and one said, the word empathy was not mentioned anywhere in there. And I thought, I guess we really need some instruction on love. And so I guess that's, I'd love to hear what you would define as loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength.
Okay, so the only way I know how to answer that at this point in my studies and life experience is to say, whatever you're reading in the Bible has been changed through interpretation and translation and culture and for a couple thousand years now, roughly.
Right.
So Michael Rice and people like him who studied the ancient Aramaic and the Hebrew have said that's not really what was said. It was said the first law is keep this loving filter open in your mind. Keep this gateway open that allows the flow of life and love to be moving through you, and use that as your primary user interface whenever you think about yourself, your neighbor, which is anybody you think about, God, your life, etc. So it's not an act of loving. It's not doing so much as it's the remembrance of what your true nature is and keeping that energetic valve or window or filter open so the truth of who you are, who you were created to be, and how Way of Mastery keeps saying that you remain as you were created to be, that the truth of that is active consciously in your mind and informs all that you think, say, do, hear, etc. So that's the only reasonable way I know to talk about this. I have not been a scholar of the Aramaic. I have not done the work that Dale Allen Hoffman has, but that kind of thing that he talks about when he says there's either 300 or 900 valid ways, different ways to interpret the first line of the book of Genesis. That lets me know I'm not an expert in this field, and I can't really talk about it. When people start saying, what does it mean, and how do you do what the Bible says here, I can't talk about it because I have a level of ignorance that is restrictive. So I go to people like Dale Allen Hoffman and Dr. Michael Rice and other people who study the ancient Aramaic, Neil Douglas Klotz, etc., and I use what they've come up with and see if it helps me spend more time in that loving energy. And then I don't worry about the rest of it. I'm not trying to follow someone's set of rules. God said this. You know, who told you God says that? Another person. Well, how they, because it's written in the Bible, and the Bible's the truth. Okay. I've learned enough over the years to know that everything that's written down in words is a product of human creation. And at the very least, even if it had a divine inspiration source, it's been colored by the humans who wrote it down, who received the signal and
right.
and translated it. So the fact
so
that
they
you're,
have their filters.
Well, yeah, and the fact that you're asking that question with some kind of intensity and emotion, and how do we do this, and what, and frustration tells me right there you're off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're when we create that energy of tension and frustration, we've missed the mark. It's like the teachings about love and peace, and I love the way Dr. Michael Rice in one of his early lectures would say, people would take the Bible and they would go to these other countries where they had no awareness of the Bible. They'd go to these, you know, indigenous cultures, and they'd say, we're here to bring you the message of our good Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, whose great pleasure it is to bring you all abundance and love. And if you won't accept this message, we're going to have to kill you.
I know. Yep.
Right? But to my way of thinking, you're getting tight and tense and thinking, wait a minute, how am I supposed to love God? And generating tension and frustration over that is exactly the same as going to the natives and saying, if you don't accept the love of God, we're going to kill you. It's the same thing. If the message is for peace and love and bliss, and you're tying yourself in knots over it, it's a misuse of thought and word. So that's the first thing I would do, is to tell you, relax, soften. You're fine just the way you are. Even if you never sort out these words, all of this stuff about what's in the Bible and what religions tell you you need to do with the Bible, all of it is just made up. That was one of the big messages in our group last night. All of this stuff, my thoughts about my purpose in life, it's all just made up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Why is that? Yeah, it's not only okay, it's a huge relief.
You could view it that way. Yeah, it's just made up. And it's okay that you're making it up. If you make it up and it brings you joy, keep doing it. If you make it up and it brings you tightness and tension, you might want to consider letting it go.
Okay.
And you know, on the one hand, it's just lovely that you have that group of people that want to get together and they want to live their lives better and differently and they want to be more loving. And on the other hand, if you're not willing to use the feedback signals from your mind-body-energy system to their optimal level to keep you in that loving state, then you're probably going to trap yourself, as David Bohm says, in sustained incoherence. And if you choose to trap yourself in sustained incoherence, no one can free you. You have to make the choice to free yourself from that. Does that make sense?
Yep.
That's one of the things that I was trying to talk about in the group last night, is that people are getting all kinds of intense emotional responses to the discussion. And I just kept trying to bring it back to the idea that, look, none of this is about who's right or wrong in this discussion. It's all about what am I doing inside myself to generate this upset. Or tension, or tightness, or fear, or anger, or indignation. So there you have it.
Okay.
I'm going to be playing a recorded file for Jeannie and Michael.
So
for this
still
next
out of
hour,
condition?
So. I don't know exactly what's happening. I just got a text message yesterday asking me to play Communication Part 2. So
He's had a foot injury or painful foot, and she's had a lot of pain in her shoulder, and they were out yesterday. And I was hoping they'd be back anyway. Well, I just want to say to you, Dr. Tim, that I loved your answer, but I don't feel very good about the fact that you took me as being so darn in my head and upset. I wasn't. I'm just was brought up in the group. Shut up.
Right,
But
Susan, I'm not saying you were so in your head. I'm just saying that when that happens and there's even a little bit of tension, we can start using that to say, oh, I'm probably off the mark. What if I just drop into my heart and I recognize that when I have the thought, I don't know how to do this. How am I supposed to do this? Even if it's a little bit of tension, what if I just drop into my heart and say, oh, Timmy, sweetheart, you're developing tension and pain. Just relax. Take a few deep breaths. You know, this is supposed to be a message of love. You're supposed to love God. And you're generating tension about it. Love is not about tension. Well, in all these deep teachings, like the Way of Mastery, go ahead and do a search in the Way of Mastery for what love is. Love allows all things. Love trusts all things. Love embraces all things. Love surrenders to all things. And thereby transcends all things. There's no efforting that can get you to the loving space that any deep spiritual teaching is calling you to. So I'm certainly not telling you that you're doing it wrong. I'm just trying to shine the light on what you're actually doing and how it's not being created by what you've heard from the Bible or what this teaching says or what the Bible says you should do with God. It's all being created inside us anytime we think we need an answer or we get tight or tense or nervous that we're doing it wrong. It's just a self-created state.
Okay, I get it.
Well, as always, I thank you greatly for your comments and conversation. It's a thrill when you put your hand up. I hope you give me credit for how many times I've seen your number there and not called on you to put your hand up, but it's great every time you do. So I'll mute you so you can listen to the second hour if that's your choice. Thanks again and blessings. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
Gee, you know, when I saw you come in the room and do that, I thought that you were angry. Now, somebody who's defensive might jump in and say, well, I wasn't angry. You know I'm never angry. Anybody ever known somebody that plays that game? It's like, no, wait. I'm not saying that you were angry. I'm just saying that I have an issue, and I felt like you were angry. That's something about me. That's not about you. And then you want to identify the issue that you have in terms that makes you responsible for it. And so oftentimes people's communication will end with, and you were angry, as though that's the problem. And the truth is, if that were an accurate scenario that you were involved in, and you were in upset, the problem is not the fact that, let's say I was angry. That's not the problem. The problem is that my anger triggered fear in you. So when you're doing the subjective observation, you're using language that reflects that this is about a reality in your mind. I'm not saying you were angry. I'm saying I felt like you were angry, and that's not the issue. What I'm realizing is that I was afraid. Now you're starting to describe your issue. And when in communication there is a conflict, there's an interesting thing that happens. We usually have two people involved in a conflict, and what happens is person one in the conflict has an issue and a problem reality. And all of their words try to convince person two that it's their fault. Person two at the same time has a problem reality, and all of their words try to convince the other person that it's their fault. So person one stands insisting that person two should fix what's going on in their mind. Person two stands insisting that person one should clean up their act so that person two won't have an upset in their mind. But remember when you looked at the two-door igloo up there? The two-door igloo came from the content of the mind looking at the situation. And when I recognize that I have a painful reality in me, if I'm going to blame everybody else for it, probably most people are going to go in the other direction. Because most people, when they were little people, tried to fix other people's realities and figured out you can't do it. And all you can do is lose. In fact, most people, when they were this high, made up realities. When they tried to fix it for somebody else, it's hopeless, it's helpless, and it's all my fault. And the minute you start telling somebody else that they're responsible for what's in your mind and that you're supposed to fix it, that usually triggers in most people, hopeless, helpless, it's my fault, and they want to leave. But your communication is about wanting to keep somebody there with you. Your communication is about creating an interaction where each person can place the reality in their mind intact into the other person's mind. You do that by using words that describe the content of your mind as though you know it's the content of your mind rather than something that's all their fault. So we're turning around the communication of the world. Because when you recognize that your mind is an evidential device and you use projection communication, you made me mad, here's what happens. You hide the part of your mind with which you create your anger, and you use that part of your mind and you put it into your brain's image of everybody else. And so now all of a sudden everybody else is responsible for your anger. Guess what you just did? You made it impossible for you to ever heal your anger. As long as you hold your mind in that posture and you use projection language, you made me angry, you're saying, mind, build me a reality about them that shows me that I have nothing to do with my anger, that it's all their fault. Now, the person who knows that they're responsible for their own upset, their own anger, their own sadness, their own fear, is going to use responsibility communication. And responsibility communication is going to look more like, you know, when such and such happened last night, that brought a lot of anger up in me. And I really want to be responsible for and heal my anger. Would you support me in that? Now, just check out how that feels. Let's imagine that any one of you watching this video right now or here in our audience, we're in a one-on-one situation. And in one case, I communicate with projection communication. You know, what you did last night was really nasty and things better change around here because you really peeved me. How does that feel to everybody? Does that warm the cockles of your heart and make you want to be right here with me and support me in my process? Not highly likely. But let's change that to some responsibility communication. You know, last night when thus and so happened, anger came up in me. And what I know is I really want to be responsible for and heal my anger. Would you support me in that? How much easier is it going to be to stay in relationship in that situation than the one where somebody's wagging their finger in your face telling you it's all your fault? It makes the difference of aliveness in relationship and death of relationship. Now, if you think about the family home that you came from, the school system that you came up in, the entertainment world that you see, the educational world that you were in, how often in any of those worlds, when you saw two people in communication with each other over an upset, did one of them turn to the other and say, you know, when you did thus and so last night, I had a lot of anger come up in me, and I'd really like to be responsible for and heal my anger. Would you support me? How many saw that as the way behavior was modeled in your world? It's virtually unheard of in our culture because our whole culture is about projection language. The whole language base of our culture is, you made me mad, you made me sad, you made me afraid, it's all your fault. And so, of course, everybody's going around holding that it's everybody else's fault because they just told their minds to show them that it's everybody else's fault. Now, I have a question for you. If you lived in that world, if it's everybody else's fault, how is it possible that they could be the one with the problem when you're the one with the pain? Something about that doesn't make sense. When you're in pain because there's an energy happening in you that doesn't belong in you. When you're in pain, it doesn't mean that somebody else did something wrong. Now, they may have, but them doing something wrong is not the cause of your pain. The cause of your pain is the fact that there is an energy in you that doesn't belong in you, and you'll keep that energy hidden from yourself as long as you use projection communication. And in fact, when you hold something painful in you that you don't want to deal with, that you don't want to look at, here's what happens. I had the privilege about 20 years ago of getting to do some work with a gentleman named Marcel Vogel, who was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM. Marcel had instrumentation in the laboratory with which to take the picture of the high-energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. Literally, if you hold something painful in you that you don't want to deal with and that you keep doing projection communication about, every time you communicate about it, that energy in you is intensified. Marcel Vogel would be able to take a picture of that intensified energy. And that intensified energy sets up a wave that literally resonates or draws somebody to you to play that out with you. And so by using projection communication, you guarantee that more and more and more people are going to come and do whatever it is that you don't want to have done with you. In fact, if there's only one person on the planet who's capable of playing that dynamic out with you, you're going to set up a resonance that will draw them to you. If that one person is in China today, they don't know what it is, what the energy is that inclined them to get on an airplane and go to New York and arrive there the same day you happen to be going to New York. They don't know what the energy was that inclined them to walk down the incorrect hallway and meet you at the corner and do whatever the behavior was. But they're going to show up in your world because you need them in your world.
Well, wait a minute. I've already got this pain in here. Why do I need somebody to inflict pain on me? What are you? You're crazy, Michael.
No. As long as you've got pain in you, you need somebody who will show you your pain so that you can change your mind about it, so that you can bring it forward to love and transform it. You need those people who can show you those parts of you. And life guarantees to provide you that, because the purpose of life, once you put something into your structure that doesn't belong there, is to kick you right square in the limitation, to show you exactly what you're holding on. And when you hang on to that, when you hang out with that continuously, you're always drawing somebody in to play it out with you. So if I come in looking angry and you go into terror when I throw the eraser, your issue is not my anger, and that's where most people want to stop. Your issue is your terror. Most people don't ever go that far in their own minds as to identifying their issue. They stop short with, well, the problem is what they did out there. No, 100% of the time, if there's pain in you, the problem is what you're feeling in here. And it's not until you communicate accurately that your mind can show you that. And once you communicate accurately and your mind can show you that, then and only then can you correct that part of your mind. And so the subjective observation identifies your thoughts and feelings, again, in terms that makes you responsible for it. And if you, the idea of this step is to reflect and own your reality, not to prove that your reality is true about them. And you want to get that reality that you hold. And what's the reality in that situation that we're describing? Well, gee, you know, the truth is I realize I've got some terror. I'd rather sit here and talk about your anger and how you threw that eraser. But the truth is, what I really need to communicate about, what I really need to get intact into your mind is that when I perceive somebody as angry, I have terror. Terror in your tissue structure, if you don't ever deal with it, will kill you. Terror is an energy that doesn't belong in human tissue. The thoughts of terror create the chemistry that destroys the cell. When you communicate accurately, you can recapture that chemistry, that energy of that thought, and bring it forward to what was called the altar. The ancient teachings, the conscious mind was called the altar, A-L-T-E-R. That's where you can alter or change an unconscious dynamic. So as long as you keep your terror hidden, then it's eating away wherever it's stored. The idea of responsibility communication is, if I have terror in me, I want to know it. I want to access it. I want to bring it up out of my cellular structure. And I want to be done with it. There's a really powerful beatitude that goes into that. It's interesting, and again, you know, talk about translations earlier. In the Beatitudes, we're told that each of the Beatitudes starts out with a statement that says, blessed are they. Blessed are they, blessed are they, blessed are they. This has got to be a really important idea, because this is Yeshua's first public teaching, and he uses that term repeatedly. The word, interestingly enough, in Aramaic is the word tuvehun. There is no justification for translating that word as blessed are they. None whatsoever. What it means in Aramaic is this. A latent or an unconscious neural structure implanted by God to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession, you who, and then what follows each time the word Blessed are they. In the Greek translations is repeated. That's what it says. And then what follows is a set of instructions for how to get that neural structure activated that the Creator put in you to start with. And the beatitude that traditionally is translated as, blessed are they mourning their wrongs, for they will be comforted. In Aramaic, here's what it translates. A latent neural structure implanted by God to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession. You who love truth, you who look into your errors in thought and the errors of your society, for you will be cured of mental stress. That's what he said 2,000 years ago. He was teaching you how to heal your diseases. He was teaching you how to access the mind energy that created destructive chemistry that would destroy you. And that if you love truth enough and you're willing to look into your errors in thought and the errors of your society, what you would do, you would be able to recapture that destructive chemistry that is in the cell, bring it back to mental awareness, and transform it. This is another piece that Paul had where he said, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. The steps were about reaccessing hidden parts of ourselves and cleaning them up so we could heal. And projection communication guarantees your inability to heal. Responsibility communication shows you the parts of you that are in need of healing. The parts of you that you need to recapture. And by taking responsibility, and a lot of people interpret responsibility as, well, are you saying I'm to blame for this? This is all my fault? Notice there's nothing in the word responsibility about fault or blame. Responsibility is simply a tool for accessing a hidden part of your mind. And when you can access those hidden parts of your mind, then you can clean them up again. This set of tools, responsibility communication, we've done 3 steps out of 7, shows the beginning point of how to access hidden parts of your mind. How to get to the point where you love truth so much that you are willing to sacrifice your story about being an innocent victim and how it's all everybody else's fault. Again, the average person who has terror about what they perceive to be someone else's anger never looks at, acknowledges, or communicates about their terror and therefore never gets to clean it up. In the Aramaic language, the word forgive has nothing whatsoever to do with letting other people off the hook because you have something painful happening inside of you. And the whole communication system of our culture is used to keep things hidden from ourselves. And what we hide from ourselves is what creates our diseases. So by loving truth enough and communicating responsibly, and owning our own issues in a situation, we give our minds permission to take things that perhaps have been hidden from us for generations. Bring them back to awareness. Some of those things we made up when we were 2 and 3 and 4 and didn't have a clue as to what was going on. Some of those things came to us genetically. It's time for us to become aware of those things again. This set of tools allows that. Let's take a short intermission. So we've looked at the first 3 steps of responsibility communication, and then the 4th step, you get to say what you want. Number 4, what I want. And at this stage, what most people do, their natural form of communication is, of course, there's an upset, so there's some form of hostility or fear. So all they want to do is solve the problem. And the problem is, you came home angry. If you just never come home angry again, everything would be fine. So they think what they want is to solve the problem. What we're going to suggest to you at this stage is that problem solving is the last thing you want to do. because you draw to you the experiences you have, because you need those experiences, and when those experiences bring pain to you, you need to be about healing your pain. You don't need to be about changing their behavior so that you never get to deal with your pain. We do a workshop called, well, actually it'll be the workshop we're doing this evening, right after this, on codependence. And what we'll see is that when one lives out of that codependent state, in that codependent state, they're limited in their behaviors. And one of the behaviors, one of the things they think will solve all their problems is if they could just control everybody in the world. And people who live out of that state of what we call non-being would simply control everybody so that nobody would approach and show them the part of themselves that they need to be responsible for and heal. And so by controlling the world, they would assure their own death, because the energy they need to heal is their physiological disease. What we're suggesting you want to do is, in coming from being, you want to own and be responsible for and find the parts of you need to heal, and with your communication enlist support for healing those parts of yourself. And so step four is a request that always relates to receiving support and healing the issue you described in number three. So what I want is, and it relates to having support for healing. And it's healing the issue identified. And you want to make sure you keep on track that you're about healing the issue you identified in number three. It's not about changing them. It's not about manipulating them. It's not about getting them to never come home angry again. It's about how do you gather support for finding the part of you that attracts that behavior repeatedly. If you utilize this as a tool to solve your problems, to get others to change, it will backfire on you. If it's used to manipulate others, it will backfire. The more specific you are in identifying your painful reality in this situation, the more powerful this will be in your healing process. And if you don't get the support you want. You know, at this stage, when you own it, you say, gee, I had pain. This brought pain up for me. You know, there are going to be some people will say, all right, good. I'm delighted. That's exactly what I wanted for you. Well, that might be the place to start looking at, what's the part of me that attracts people who don't support me? Why do I feel like I need to be in a space of no support? And it might be a place to turn to one of the other tools. You might pick up the reality management sheet. You might pick up the commitment from the Healing Through Relationships workshop. And so this isn't the only tool that we're offering. There's a whole range of tools. And, of course, this would tend to be a tool you would use more often in situations where you've got some cooperation, where you can elicit some support for healing. And so if you don't gather support, then you start looking at, what's the part of me that I need to heal that feels like I don't deserve support because I'm obviously not creating support in my world? And so it becomes a big clue. Now, the next step in the process of healing can be an extremely difficult step, because what you have to do is you have to actually listen to the person you're talking to as though they were intelligent. And they might have some answers for you. Now, your mind believes that they're the problem. because you're able to hide the part of you that's in need of healing. When you bring two people together that are in conflict, you've got two people who have painful realities that they need to be responsible for and heal. When they set up responsibility communication, they'll stop playing the game of, I think you should change my mind, and this person says, and I think you should change my mind, and so neither mind ever gets changed. Into a cooperative effort for where each takes responsibility, and person one says, you know, I realize I have a painful reality, and I really want to be about healing that. Would you support me? And person two says, and you know what? I have a painful reality too, and I'd really like to gather some support for healing that. Let's join in support of doing that, rather than each one standing insisting that the other one's got to fix our mind. So you actually treat this person as though they've got some intelligence, and the person who can resonate the problem that you have is very likely the person who carries the energy of the solution if you can set up an actual healing situation. So you start number five out with, do you have any ideas? And the reason you do that is because if you're in pain, and a lot of people say, well, you know, I know what my problem is. If you knew what your problem was, your problem would be solved. The minute that you have a problem and you're in some kind of turmoil or pain, and you hold that you already know what your problem is, you're lying to yourself. You don't know what your problem is, or you would have already taken care of it. Your non-being mind, this mind of hostility and fear, says, I know what the problem is, and that's its total projection. And so this set of tools is about bringing responsibility back and finding those parts of me that I've been hiding from myself. It's about moving out of blockage of truth into love of truth. And so you ask this question with an open mind, not a mind that thinks it already knows the answer. And if they don't give you the answer you want, you get upset with them. So in number five, it's, do you have any ideas? Now, in the situation we talked about with the eraser and all, let's say that my response to you is, as you ask if I have any ideas, is, well, you know, let's sit down to a worksheet. We'll take the reality management worksheet from Why Is This Happening to Me Again, that forgiveness process, and we'll do that process. And so we do the worksheet, and all of a sudden, boom, there you are. You discover that, gee, when I was a kid, you know, Dad was an alcoholic. I was the smallest one in the family. And half the time when Dad was drunk, he was a happy drunk and he had gifts for us all. And the other half of the time he was an angry drunk and he beat up on us. And all the big kids in the family pushed me out when he came to the door so that they could figure out which mood he was in and whether they needed to scatter or be first in line to get the gifts he had. So that's a major issue that someone would hold in their physiology, because at least half the time they went out, they got beat up. So that might be the discovery in the worksheet process for this person. And then, having discovered that, it might be time to add another solution into the healing process, or another step into it. So in number six, I might feel, as I get in touch with that trauma and the, you know, the actual body trauma of that memory, I might decide that, gee, you know what I really need to do is do some still point breathing. Would you breathe me? So there's a place for you, once you've listened to their solution and participated, there's a place for you to offer, I think, what would help is, and you might ask for support in doing a breath session. And so you've moved through a lot of issues in doing this responsibility communication. And doing one worksheet and one breath session might not be an end of having been pushed out 100 times in front of somebody who was angry and beat up on you. So then in step seven, the final step in the process of responsibility communication is there might be need for problem solving. You know, gee, I realize that I have this issue of terror when somebody comes in. You know, I was reading that book and you came in and, gee, I didn't realize that you were trying out for a play and you had to come in looking angry and didn't even realize I was in the room. I just thought you were terrorizing me. And so how about now that we've discovered I have this issue and it might be one of my 77 times 70 worksheet issues, this isn't going to all disappear in one session. How about we problem solve here? And problem solving might look like, you know, if you have one of those bad days at the office and you're angry, you know that I'm sensitive to somebody coming home like that and surprising me. How about if you just pick up the phone before you come and say, hey, you know, I've had one of those bad days. Be aware of it and don't pay any attention to what I say or do. So now we've solved the problem and we've done the healing work that's necessary. And the way that that was done was through responsibility communication. Once somebody can, without blame, put the reality that's between their ears into the mind of another person, understanding unfolds. When you couch the reality between your ears in words that make somebody else to blame, it tends to cut communication. When you can utilize responsibility communication, it gets a whole lot easier for someone to hear you. I have another letter I'd like to share with you from a young man this time who did this workshop and took these tools to address a long-standing issue that he had had with his father around alcohol. This young man, and again, I've got his permission to share this, this young man had been an alcoholic and gone through AA and several treatment programs and finally came across this work and really started to work with this work. In fact, he's taught this work. And this is a letter that he wrote his dad about responsibility communication and opening some new levels of communication with his father. And it's in response to an email that his father sent to him about his sister. So he writes back to him, "Hi, Dad. Thank you for opening the door for conversation. I would like to talk with you to clear ever more space for our relationship. My commitment is to always be responsible for my own limited views on reality and refrain from projecting my feelings onto you or anyone else. So to first answer the question, was I ticked off at you? The answer is that no, I was not. Honest, I was very conscious of what was going on for me, and it wasn't that. What was going on? Well, as you know, I do a lot of spiritual work every day, meditation, prayer, worksheets, etc. The goal of that work is simple. I hold it to be true that we are all love, and that love is our essential nature, our essence. And all we need do is forgive all thoughts or energies that are less than love, and we will come into full expression as the incredible people that we are. Sometimes, often, this process is not Dr. Feelgood. It requires real courage to consistently be responsible for how I feel and how I see the world, others, and myself. As you know, it takes courage to take responsibility for, and then he's got in brackets, so I can heal with God's help, feelings that are painful and may have been suppressed for decades. So yesterday, perhaps because I've been doing a lot of processing lately, some of my old painful realities kind of came up in my face. I admire your perceptiveness from yesterday because you picked up that a lot of my hostility was up, and I would like to ask for your support to share it and heal it. I think the trigger for me yesterday was the glass of red wine next to you on the deck. I saw it and reacted like Pavlov's dog. In spite of myself, I was filled with this hostility from the past. I share this with you now for two reasons. One is to process my feelings, to be responsible and let go, so that whatever you do or say in the future, I will be able to hold a space of love inside myself, when we're together physically or even just in my thoughts. This is not about manipulating you or getting you to change your behavior. It's about continuing to create an honest relationship with you, especially where honesty has not existed before. The second reason is because I owe you the truth. As part of your support team, I owe it to you to speak about things that I see as potential blind spots or trouble spots. I have been bothered recently by the thought that Robin, in a significant way, Robin is his sister, has been a more faithful daughter to you than I have been a son. She spoke her honest thoughts to you, specifically about drinking, regardless of what feelings or reaction it might trigger. Her intentions may or may not have been loving ones, but my intentions are supportive and loving for both of us. Dad, for years, my brother and I have treasured the opportunity to go with to you with our life's challenges. I will continue to love and to turn to you. We have also known that we had to do it during the day, preferably a work day, because you're just not the same person at night or on Sunday afternoon. This is because of alcohol. There is a shift in you after you've had two or three drinks. Not every time, maybe, but certainly sometimes. There is often a strongly sarcastic energy, sometimes only toward the TV, that comes out that is not present in you when you're sober. Why did this glass of wine bring up so much hostility in me yesterday? I can only guess that it has to do with suppression over many years. I have come to recognize this as a family motto. It's been passed from generation to generation. I noticed it on the phone when I was offering Mom support in her effort to stop drinking. She admitted that she felt angry at the fact that I even brought it up. Imagine that. After all I've been through with detox and AA and all, I've been humbled completely in this area. It's still not permitted in our family culture for me to offer support to Mom in her effort to drop alcohol. That happened 2 days ago, and it brought some tender feelings up for me. I see it in comments from my grandmother regarding a book about the Irish and Southie. She told our cousin, that never happened. Nobody ever did that. That book was a Pulitzer Prize-winning autobiography of a child's memories. Of course it happened. This is how our brains work, though. If something is painful, we think we can make it go away by condemning even the thought of it. Can you imagine saying to Nanny when you were a child, Mom, I'd like to have a serious talk with you about the way you talk to Dad. It really brings pain up for me when you say harsh things to him. I don't think you ever had a safe relationship with either of your parents to do what we now have the opportunity to do. I honor you and Mom for creating a family structure that is so loving that I am now sending you this note. You and Mom have done incredible work for our whole family line. Also know that our relationship and our family is more important than any issue. I am in it forever. And, as a friend once said to me, in it to win it. We can win as a family by always growing in love. In too many families, these things get taken to the grave, literally. I can remember being a child and even mentioning a word about Mom drinking and being harshly treated for bringing up that subject. It was taboo and not my place as a child to talk about it. I learned that it wasn't safe to discuss. When I got older, I learned that I could express ideas that seemed unsafe by using sarcasm. Now I know the devastating effects on my own body of using sarcasm. The word actually comes from a term that means to tear flesh. It is as destructive to the body as smoking is, I suspect. So I don't do it anymore, and when I'm conscious of my behavior, I change it. You only need to listen to Uncle Bob on any given holiday to notice how sarcasm is a means of expressing hostility that we have each been raised to suppress. So that's all part of what was going on for me yesterday. I would like to talk about it with you in a positive space. I also, in a general way, will commit to getting out of your face. I've noticed, and I didn't like it, my own behavior at the beach house, telling you you have to change if you want to be healthy at 77. That was a stupid approach to you, and not who I want to be. I promise to work toward always giving you the space to do and be what you choose, as I now have the space to do and be what I choose. I guess this is all about letting go of resentment that I created in myself because I felt I couldn't be honest with you in a safe way. If it's not appropriate for me to be around you in a certain state, I'll make sure that I make the choice for myself and find something else to do. I imagine that this statement may bring up some tender feelings for you. If so, notice that I'm always there to support you. I'm always committed to being your son to the best of my ability. So if you're feeling something like, son, I know drinking is not the healthiest choice for me. I have thought about stopping, but I think my life works fine with it and I enjoy it. Then I can support your right to choose and I begin to truly mind my own business. Knowing that you know where I stand and being free from pretending, it's not a factor in my life or our relationship because it's been a huge factor. I'm 33 now. I'm responsible for me. You are responsible for you. In that context, I'm ready to start again and support you in any way I can. With love. How many of us have ever had a challenge with a family member that included issues at that depth? Maybe not that particular issue, but issues at that depth. And the minute we opened the door to communication, the communication was about blame and what they had done and how they destroyed. Do you see the shift that takes place when this young man has the courage to take responsibility? And as you think about the stages and the steps in that letter, how huge the issues are that he's just finally faced at the age of 33 and worked through right there in two pieces of paper. Issues that, as he says, oftentimes go to the grave with us. Communication is such an important key in our relationships that without it, relationships wither and die. Projection communication causes the death of relationship. Responsibility communication not only brings relationship back to life, but it opens the internal dynamics of the person who's doing the responsibility communication so that the hidden parts of their minds can be seen. And when those hidden parts can be seen, they can be changed. We can move out of the world, I'm right, you're wrong, it's settled, why argue? And as we do that, we can undo a lifetime of issues that have come from a multitude of generations. Because on an energetic level, we inherit the ways of dealing with things that our parents had and their parents and their parents. And we tend to pass those on to our children. When you recognize that the mind is an evidential device and you start to speak responsibly through it, you give it permission to see evidence totally differently. How many young men have raged at their fathers for their alcohol use and shattered their family systems? That letter that I wrote earlier, how many people in business situations, when they were unjustly accused, which that young woman obviously was unjustly accused, how many people just destroy what potentially holds great gifts for them? And as she was able to utilize responsibility communication, she opened some doors in business situations that otherwise she could have just slammed shut and been angry about for the rest of her life. Held resentment about. And resentment, I would offer, you know, there's a lot of conversation in the culture these days about flesh-eating bacteria. Guess what's going to create an environment on a cellular level for that kind of an organism to thrive? That's exactly the thing that's going to create the ideal environment. You know, there's that old saying, if you feed them, they will come. When you put an energy into tissue, we talked about Bruce Lipton, cell biologist, you think a thought, produces a neuropeptide, the neuropeptide becomes the chemistry. If you put destructive chemistry into a cell, that cell starts to deteriorate, and that cell becomes food for the bacteria that go along with deterioration. When you can recapture through responsibility communication that which, when we look at the tiny, you know, an energetic wave, they talk about the quantum waves. A quantum wave, when collapsed into a cell that is of a destructive nature, looks like a thing we call a chemical. But when we can communicate, what we'll find is when we take that out of suppression in the cell, we stop the deterioration of the cell, we access and bring it from its collapsed so-called chemical condition back to the wave, and the wave can then be removed from the structure. In the ancient Aramaic language, removing from your structure those waves that never belonged in a human structure becomes key. And the forgiveness process. If you haven't done the workshop, Why Is This Happening to Me Again?, I suggest that you get some materials on that workshop. You can go to our website, download and read the book for free. Get the instructions on the forgiveness process. It shows how to take all of those waves that we've collapsed into our chemistry that supports, because there's degeneration happening and there's certain organisms that feed on degeneration, that supports us being able to access those parts of ourselves and bring those parts forward for healing. When you unload what does not belong in the cell will naturally go back and rebuild itself. Because, you know, if you look back, you know, people will say, well, this person has a diseased heart or lung or liver or what have you. If you go back to the single cell at conception, there was no heart, no lung, no liver. What was there was an energetic pattern and an intelligence that built out of that energetic pattern a heart, a lung, or a liver. If someone puts into that heart or lung or liver an energy that doesn't belong there, then a degenerative process starts to take place, which we call disease. And all that's happening in that degenerative process is the power that continuously rebuilds each organ. You know, if you look at soft tissues, depending whose numbers you take, somewhere between 60 and 120 days, every cell of every organ in your body, the soft tissue and body, is totally regenerated. It's totally rebuilt. Now, it is either rebuilt according to the original perfect set of instructions, or if you've overlaid hostilities and fears upon it, those instruction sets are deteriorated and the resulting organs are deteriorated. When we can go back and recapture those energies with forgiveness and with responsibility communication, we literally remove those instruction sets that cause the deterioration, and the next generation of cells come out healthier. Now, most people think that that process has to do with time, because usually they watch it happening over a period of time. Well, you know, 10 years ago this guy had a healthy liver, and here he is now, and it's degenerating. It must be because there was 10 years in between. Well, it's interesting, in the Chinese language, the word for liver is the same word as the word anger. And if someone is continuously loading their liver up with anger, then their livers will start to degenerate over time. But time has got nothing to do with it. It's got to do with the qualities of energies that go in and interfere with the instruction sets for rebuilding. Responsibility communication allows you to recapture those instruction sets. And if they're no longer appropriate, if they come from hostility or fear and do not support your being, then by recapturing them, you get to forgive. You get to remove what never belonged in your structure in the first place. And that's the whole goal of this work, is to take us to the point where we can do that. Now, if you're going to take this set of tools, or as you take this set of tools, one of the things that tends to happen is people take real life situations where they have real life emotions, and the first time out of the chute, they take this and they go, now I'm going to do responsibility communication with you. Guess how long that's going to last if you've got 20, 30, 40, 50 years of projection communication? It's going to last until the first emotion comes up, and you're going to be right back to the old pattern. So there's a rule that goes along with using these communication tools, responsibility communication, and I call it the rule of the three P's. Practice, practice, practice. You want to go to work with these tools, and you want to use them in a way that you're not confronting real-time emotional issues for you. So you want to pick out some silly situation, and using that silly situation, take the responsibility communication sheet. By the way, if you're watching this on video and you don't have a copy of the instruction set, you can go to our website, www.whyagain.com, whyagain.com, and download the worksheet. You just click on the right-hand side. There's a button that says worksheets, and you'll see that in that spot. But you take the worksheet, and you follow the steps step by step, and pick some ridiculous situation. You know, go to a nursery rhyme book and open it up. The cow jumped over the moon and the dish ran away with the spoon. Well, I have an issue. You know, I'd like to get this issue cleaned up, and I ask for your support in working through it. Objective observation. The cow jumped over the moon. Subjective. Now, I'm really upset because I was told that cows couldn't fly. And so I realize that I've got some upset that I'd like to heal. Do you have any ideas of how I might heal that upset? And here are some of my ideas. And by the way, it was my spoon, and I really don't like them taking my, you know, take something ridiculous like that. And what you do is you build the brain cells. If you go back to Yeshua, he said that his work and his teaching were only for those who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear. I think we can fairly safely assume that most everybody in his audience had what we called physical eyes and ears. It wasn't about the physical eyes and ears. What it was about was those who had the brain cells. Remember our conversation about the two-door igloo? In order for the man from Guatemala to even start to be able to conceive of a two-door igloo, he had to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. He had to have the information stored in brain cells so his mind could even conceive of such a thing. In order to even conceive of responsibility communication, you've got to build the brain cells for it. Now, we've started today in our workshop with building those brain cells. But there's a challenge in bringing this into actualization in your life. And the challenge is that you have a lot of brain cells that go in a totally different direction about communication. You have different goals for communication. There are a couple of things that you need to do if you really want to make this a functional tool for you. One is, get a hold of that forgiveness process, the reality management sheet, and start to forgive. That is, remove those old goals that have you going in another direction, using communication for blame or to overpower somebody or to win or whatever it is that you've used your communication for in the past. And then build the brain cells for what responsibility looks like. Build the brain cells for what it looks like to describe the reality that I hold in my mind with words that indicate that I know this is my reality and it's not about you. When I can do that, I will recapture 1,000 generations of insanity from my past. And as I recapture and put an end to those generations, you know, you might remember that story about Moses and that whole group wandering in the desert for 40 years. Does anybody remember what had to happen in order for them to get out of the desert and into the promised land? They said the old generation had to die off. That didn't mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die. The root of the word generation is genari. It means cause. All of the old causes held in brain cells from the previous generations had to be uprooted. This is how to go directly to what needs to be uprooted. Uproot it and create a safe community of support around you for healing those dynamics in yourself. There's a very powerful proverb that comes out of Africa. And what that proverb says is, if you want to go far, go together. If you want to go quickly, go alone. Most people don't go very far in cleaning up their genetic past, their generations, if they try to do it on their own. They've got to be part of and build a community of support for being able to work through that. And that's what these tools are about. That's what these tools are for, is to undo the parts of our minds that don't work, that don't really support us, to uproot the generational patterns that keep us locked into hostility or fear. Our normal state as human beings is that of aliveness, joy, and creativity. Your structure, I would offer, is a custom-designed device that is designed to experience the active presence of love on a cellular level 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Why is that? It's because you are made of the stuff called love. You live, move, and have your being in the stuff called love. Now, I've had people say, well, gee, Michael, you know, if I'm made of love and I live, move, and have my being in love and the Creator is love, why don't I feel it? Oh, you, being gifted as a creator, have created for yourself other gods. And those other gods, when they are active in your mind, create graven images of hostility and fear. And you hold those graven images of hostility and fear before the love that you were designed for. If your generations have taught you to do that, then you have an habitual way of behaving that maintains the gods you worship most. And your feelings will tell you which gods you worship. You know, something unusual or something wonderful about the human being is that we're the only creature we know of that has the power of choice. We're the only creature we know of that can originate consciously mind energy. Every other creature's got to obey. There is no other creature that can make new choices like we can, at least not that we know of. You know, you're not going to find a pair of robins that come home here after the winter is done and land in your backyard, and one of the robins turns to the other and says, you know, dear, we come to this beautiful backyard in Oklahoma City every year, and every year we come here, we build a robin's nest. I think this year we should build an Oriole model. I was looking at one of those when we were down in Florida. You're not going to find a robin that does that. The robin has within it the brain cells, the vibration, the guidance system, to build a robin's nest. It can't change its mind. You are not going to find a salmon swimming in the warm South Pacific waters when it gets the call that says, say what? What was that you wanted me to do? Let me get this straight now. You want me to swim away from these nice warm South Pacific waters, 3,000 miles, yeah, to that icy cold stream in which I was spawned. And then what is it you want me to do? You want me to swim upstream against the current, yeah. Let me get this clear. You want me to get beat half to death on the rocks, lay eggs, die, and as my body breaks up, the hatching eggs will eat my flesh and become the next. No, I think I'll stay here. You're not going to find a salmon that says, I'm going to stay here. It's going to do exactly what it was told to do because it can't originate mind energy. You were the only creature that was given the ability to engage in original creation. And if you and or your generation have engaged in the creation of a mindset of hostility and fear, it's time to change your mind. You were made for the embodiment of love. It's the stuff each newborn is made of. It is what you are made of. I join you and support you in being love in the world.